Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see everyone. Special welcome today to a number of folks from Hokyoji who are here. So glad to see you. Dokai's here. Welcome, Dokai. Always great to see you. So today we've got a little different setup, you may have noticed. That's because we're having our Buddha's birthday celebration at the end of my talk. Today's April 7th. Buddha's birthday is traditionally celebrated on April 8th. So we're pretty close. And we'll have some special guests who will explain what this is. So for my talk today, I'm going to talk about Keizan Zenji, one of our Zen ancestors, sometimes known as Keizan Jokien. And ancestors are very important in Zen because we believe that there is something that is taught outside of the scriptures, which can only really be taught in the student-teacher relationship. And it passes down the generations from warm hand to warm hand. On Saturdays here, we chant the names of the Indian and Chinese ancestors, and then Dogen, who was the first Japanese ancestor. Dogen was born in the year 1200. So our chant, a little portion of it is, Great Teacher Eihei Dogen, Great Teacher Koan Eijo, Great Teacher Tetsu Gikai, Great Teacher Keizan Jokien. So Keizan, whom I'm talking about this morning, was three generations after Dogen. And I chose him because he's a very major figure in Soto Zen. He and Dogen are generally recognized as the two most important figures in Soto Zen. And yet, he doesn't get that much attention. One Japanese writer said that even in Japan, he has not been studied very much at all. And there are very few commentaries on his major work, which is the Denkoroku. And I've always been intrigued by Keizan because I've heard on many occasions that Dogen is regarded as the father of Zen and Keizan as its mother. And I'm aware that there are both fatherly and motherly qualities in our tradition, and thinking that I may have some motherly qualities myself, I want to know more about what he was like, this guy who is known as the mother of Zen. But what really prompted me to take a look into this at this time is a trip that I'm taking. I'm leaving Friday. I'm very, very fortunate. I'm going to be able to go to Japan for the 700th anniversary of Keizan's passing. And to mark that anniversary, the Soto Zen International Center and some other folks have invited maybe a couple of hundred people from around the world to come to Japan and visit Eiheiji, which was the monastery that Dogen founded, and Sojiji, which was Keizan's monastery. So it's a good time to look into Keizan. And Ben Connolly and Cato Thotland are going on this trip as well. Ben is in Japan already. So it'll be great to see them over there as well as a number of other friends. And I'm going to shave my head and my beard, so you may not recognize me after Wednesday. People tend to, literally not recognize me when I do that. Kind of fun. So I think it's just really great that we can do this trip, and I'm looking forward to it because it's great to have actual contact and actually practice with people from other cultures, from people in other traditions, because this is an embodied practice. And just being with somebody practicing can teach us so much more than we can learn from reading their words. And I think we saw this at a recent weekend retreat we had with a number of people, maybe 15 people or so came to join us in a retreat, folks from the Vietnamese bamboo forest tradition. And one person who went to that retreat said that they were so deeply inspired by Venerable Tuan Bac, by her joy by her way of being, that it was kind of a major, kind of a turning point in their practice. So how people carry themselves is something that we can really learn a lot from. And I'm so happy that we have the direct connections. Over the past few years, we've developed these direct connections with people in China, Japan, and Vietnam. So that's great. So I'm going to tell you Kazon's story. I hope you find it interesting. I do. And as I researched Kazon, a kind of a theme developed, which has, I think, some implications for our Sangha and its future. And I'm calling this talk Kazon and the Popularization of Zen. As with all things, when it comes to popularization, there is some tension there, maybe between form and emptiness. But as with all things, there is also harmony, or the possibility of harmony. So some of my talks are shaded more toward new people, and I ask experienced people to be very patient. This one's shaded maybe a little more toward experienced people. So I'm going to ask new people to be patient as I give you a lot of really nerdy facts and things. So Kazon Zenji was born around 1267 in Fukui Prefecture near the west coast of Japan. And that's actually, Fukui is actually where we'll be meeting up with our group. And I'll be staying in Fukui overnight. And his death date seems a little uncertain, but the Soto Zen folks are marking the 700-year anniversary this year. So that would make his death date 1324. He died at the age of 61. He became a monk early at the age of 8, 12, or 13. Accounts vary. And it's said that his mother urged him to become a monk, that she was greatly devoted to the Bodhisattva of great compassion. So he entered the monastery at Eiheiji, which had been founded by Dogen, and he studied under Koan Eijo from our chant, and then Eijo's successor, Tetsu Gikai, also from our chant. And then he left Eiheiji at the age of 17 to study with many different masters, as people often did in those times. They would travel around and study with different masters. Also, he studied with people from many different traditions, including Tendai. And I think he was very accomplished. He was made Ino at one temple, and probably they would have liked for him to stay, but he kept moving. And he made his way back to Eiheiji. And at the age of 30, he had his great awakening when he heard Tetsu Gikai say, "Ordinary mind is the way." Ordinary mind is the way. Could that be true? Could ordinary mind be the way? I mean, this mind we have right now, this sometimes ridiculous, sometimes pathetic mind, could this be the way? Pretty good question. Maybe there's something about acceptance there. Maybe there's something about things being okay, no matter how they are. So he became Kazon, the second abbot of a temple called Daijoji in 1300. He was abbot there for 10 years. He wrote his major work, the Denko Roku, there. He spent a lot of time then establishing temples in different parts of Japan. And he would assign his best students to take over these temples. And later, he became chief abbot of a place called Shogakuji. He renamed it Shogaku Zan Sojiji. So Sojiji, again, is the place I'll be going. Some sources say he founded Sojiji, but clearly it already existed when he got there. I think it was actually founded by Tetsu Gikai after he was banished from Eiheiji, because there was a great deal of intrigue there that we don't need to get into. So by the way, Sojiji was relocated to Yokohama, which is near Tokyo, around the beginning of the 20th century after a big fire. And so that's where I'll be going, to Yokohama. The original monastery was on the Noto Peninsula in Japan, which you may have heard of because there was a big earthquake there on January 1st, and a lot of temples were damaged. So we're going to be bringing some monetary contributions with us, and also some 50th anniversary t-shirts from MZMC to contribute to a charity bazaar. So a huge fact about Kazan, and something I admire about him, is that under him, Soto Zen went from a few small monasteries to becoming the largest of all Buddhist sects in Japan. And at its peak, it had 25,000 temples and 10 million followers. And it's still the largest Buddhist denomination in Japan. And today, Sojiji is ranked evenly with Eheiji. They are the two great monasteries of Soto Zen. And most people say Keizan became the greatest of Zen ancestors after Dogen. And he's one of the few that we do, the Doshi does a full bow to on Saturday morning. We chant the names of the ancestors. So that's another reason I really like him. He was an administrator and a very good one. So he's kind of a role model. I wasn't born with a love of administration. And when I first came to Zen Center, I tended to avoid it. And I never wanted to go to board meetings or be on the board. But it's really grown on me over the years. And administration and doing well in meetings and organizing things is not just planning. It's practice. It's interconnection. It's living the Dharma. So here's the theme that emerged from my research. Francis Cook, who's a well-known translator and scholar, said that in order for all of this growth to happen, Dogen's religious vision had to be translated for the masses. Hence my title, including the word popularization, which I thought was maybe would be kind of a provocative word, because popular, who wants to be popular? You know, what is this, high school? Doesn't sound very Zen, but I think it's interesting. So Francis Cook describes Dogen's style as austere, non-compromising, and eremitical. I had to look that word up. It means characterized by ascetic solitude. And he said that if Keizan had retained this style, Soto Zen could not have become widespread. So the spread of Zen didn't just happen. Keizan had to make a lot of changes. And one change he made was to ritual. As a young person going from temple to temple, he encountered many different kinds of ritual, and he incorporated rituals and liturgy from outside Zen that had more appeal. And Jiyu Kennett, in her introduction to the Denko Roku, says that Keizan developed the majority, if not the entirety, of the ceremonies presently used in Soto, which was a little bit of a surprise to me, because I really thought that most of this stuff came from Dogen, but it turns out it comes from Keizan. I think Dogen really established the tone, but Keizan really refined it. So I'm just going to read a little section. This is from Zen Master Keizan's monastic regulations. And this is just describing the period from 5 to 7 a.m. at the monastery. Toward the end of the period of Torah, when the signal of this preliminary breaking of silence is about to end, immediately after the time announcing the fifth phase of the fifth night watch, the drum beats and the strikes of the metal plate of the kitchen hall are simultaneously performed in three long serialized sequences. This is called the major release from silence. The practitioners fold up their quilts and bed mats, because they sleep right there where they meditate, wrap them with the cover sheet, and place the Keza robe on top. After covering the quilt with the robe wrapper cloth and putting on the formal footwear, okay, so far this may not sound much like what we do, but keep listening. They lift the Keza robe with both hands and raise it above their heads. Then joining the palms together respectfully, they recite the vow in the following verse. How great this Keza robe of deliverance is, this formless garment, yet a merit-producing field. Donning this robe, the teaching of the Tathagata, I vow to help every living being toward deliverance. And you may recognize that, because that is our robe chant. It's simply a different translation of it. Having recited the verse three times, they don the Keza robe and sit on their seats facing the floorboard, i.e. the aisle, to wait for the time of morning gruel. And we still have morning gruel, which can be very good after a couple of seasons. So other ways in which Keizan helped to popularize Buddhism, his writing was more accessible than Dogen's, but then whose isn't? And he reached out to the local community. He really reached out to lay people. For one thing, he attended to their funeral needs, which is a very important thing for people. And during the medieval period in Japan, Buddhism was accessible only to the imperial household members, court nobles, and a few priests who were sanctioned by the government. So teaching Buddhism to the masses was actually strictly prohibited. But Keizan, to his credit, at the age of 25, took the Bodhisattva vow that he would help all people, including lay people, including men and women, to realize the Buddha way by developing warm relations with them. And I hope this isn't an oversimplification, but I think I can say that Dogen tended toward a style in which a small number of monks might practice together. Cook says it was severe, demanding, and uncompromising and had a purist streak in it. He said it was not likely to attract many people, but most likely Dogen didn't really care whether it did or not. But Keizan had a more pragmatic style that brought many more people in. And one writer actually uses the word secularization for what Keizan did, saying that he changed the practices to best fit the needs of Zen temple communities and lay communities. And I'm sure, based on my experience in the modern world, that there were folks who thought this pragmatic, popular style was just great, and others who probably thought that it was just terrible. Another writer, Shohei, says that whether we're talking about the East or the West, every person and every individual experiences the stress of two opposing forces. We're pulled in an otherworldly direction to seek the truth that transcends the changes of history, but we're also pulled in the this worldly direction of meeting the needs of the historical period. That's the basic tension. And I think these opposing forces are embodied by Dogen and Keizan, the father and the mother. We can think of a small regimented place, or we can think of a warm, large, welcoming place. And maybe the way I just stated that kind of shows you what my bias is. I kind of like the large, warm, welcoming place. And that tension continues in the Soto Zen community today, and it always will, I think. There are so many little decisions we make that implicate this big, big kind of debate about who we should be. Should we be a smaller or a larger community? We have questions about how pure to keep the forms, the Japanese forms that we use. Questions about what kind of programming we offer, how many priests we ordain, how we train them, how we represent ourselves to the public. All of this implicates this question. And I know that there are people who would probably prefer a smaller, tighter community. And there are others who love the idea of bringing the practice to many different people. I like growth myself. I really like the idea of Buddhism becoming available to more people. Perhaps because I spent so much of my life in smaller towns where I felt a little bit isolated. But, you know, at one time, this was the only Zen center in the Midwest. And now there are four major Zen centers in the Twin Cities. And we have Hokyoji and Ryumonji and other places. And we have Buddhism, Zen Buddhism showing up in smaller towns like Northfield and Bemidji, larger places like Duluth and Fargo Moorhead. It's just great. It's wonderful. And I would like to do what I can to help promote this. But we don't proselytize. We don't go around saying you should be Buddhist and we must expand. We make it available. And if people don't want it, we'll come back. That'll be okay. And of course, balance is the key. Balance is the key. And you'll just give me a second. I'll make sure I didn't miss something here. Yeah, good. Okay. So this is from Shohei, from Ichimori Shohei, director of North American Institute of Zen and Buddhist Studies. Not to be confused with Shohei Ohtani, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. By the way, we have an extended adopted family connection in Japan. So we asked our extended adopted family members what they would like for us to bring them from America. And they said, Shohei Ohtani t-shirts. That's what we're bringing, baseball. So Shohei says that, of course, balance is the key, that this formal expression of secularization, as he calls it, must be happily balanced with the otherworldly force, so we can be sure that the result is most authentic in form and spirit, benefiting a given time and place, form and emptiness, acting in form, informed by emptiness. So Dogen's approach and Kazan's approach complement each other. And we're really lucky we have both of them in our lineage. We need them both. And we'll always be working on that balance, tradition and innovation, purity and pragmatism, form and emptiness. And the process in which our community resolves these things is our practice. And I believe that we can have that balance. I think we can have a very tight and disciplined and strong and traditional practice at the center of what we do and still be able to include a large number of people, because we have so many people with such a strong practice who have been doing this for such a long time. For practice period, which just started, I think we have 55 people. We have a lot of new people, but we have a lot of really experienced people too, and there is room for everyone. And so we preserve the forms, but not so rigidly. We know that Zen has to adjust to North America, and we're open to that, but we're not too quick to do that. And we certainly won't be careless about it. So I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about Kazan's major work, which is the Denko Roku, translated as the record of the transmission of the light. And this is from a series of talks he gave, probably starting in 1300. No one read this, hardly, for about 557 years until it was published again. And it's the story of the 53 ancestors in the supposedly unbroken lineage who preceded Kazan. So it starts with Shakyamuni Buddha. It goes through Koan Ajo, who is Dogen's successor. So 28 in India, 22 in China, 2 in Japan. I think the ancestors in here are identical to the ones who are in the lineage papers that we give out. So later, of course, after Kazan's time, there would be many more ancestors in Japan and some in the United States, 80 some. I don't know exactly where we're at right now. And so when we chant on Saturdays the names of the ancestors, we end with Dainin Katagiri, Karen Suna, Tim Burkett. Well, Tim Burkett's not on there yet, but there's Tim and then there are others. And happily, our lineage includes Karen Suna, who is also not on there yet, fortunately. Happily, it includes Karen Suna because you will note that everyone else in this lineage is male, except Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajnatara, I think is rumored to have been a female. We're not sure. But men and women practice separately in China, India, and Japan, and women were not given their due. So on Saturdays, we chant two lists of names of women ancestors as well in an effort to begin to rectify this. So John Dido Lurie says that Kazan wrote the Denko Roku because of the conflicts at Aheiji. People were fighting about who the legitimate Zen people were. And he wrote this because he wanted to emphasize that Zazen and realization are at the heart of the practice, which I think is very wonderful because despite his administrative bent and his desire to expand the practice, he valued the essence of our practice above all. And of course, you have to do that. You cannot dilute the essence. I should note that Cook says that much of the lineage in India is actually historically inaccurate because there was no patriarchal transmission in India. So that's a kind of detail that excites me. Are you still with me? Okay. So each chapter begins with a koan, and they're often used for koan study. And then next, there's kind of a little biography, and then there's a teisho, which is Kazan's insight into the koan. And finally, there's a two-line verse. And the one you may be most familiar with is the first one, Shakyamuni Buddha, because at Rohatsu, when we do the Rohatsu service, we chant that. It takes about 10 minutes. But I'd like to take just a quick look at one chapter from this book, which is Ananda, who was the second ancestor after Shakyamuni Buddha. And first, there is the case, and it's a koan, which also appears elsewhere. Ananda asked Kashyapa, "The world honored one gave you the golden robe. Did he give you anything else?" "Ananda," cried Kashyapa. "Yes, sir," answered Ananda. Knock down the flagpole at the gate," said Kashyapa. So Ananda asked, "The world honored one gave you the golden robe. Did he give you anything else?" "Ananda, yes, sir," knock down the flagpole at the gate. So Kashyapa is the second ancestor. Ananda will be the third ancestor. He may have had an inkling that this was coming. And he's asking about what's going on. What is this transmission like? What do you get? Because he's not enlightened yet, we know from the stories. And there are a lot of different ways that this koan could be interpreted, but I'll just say that I think it follows kind of a pattern where Ananda is hung up on discriminative thinking. How does transmission work? What did you get? What might I get? And of course, real awakening is far beyond getting anything. And Kashyapa, rather than entering into this game of discriminative thinking, says immediately, he just calls his name, Ananda. It's a shout to get his attention. Robert Aitken says, nothing gets one's attention more keenly than hearing one's name. So he's just kind of, you know, cutting through everything. Ananda, like, knock it off or wake up. And Ananda says, yes, sir. Good answer. He's fully present. Knock down the flagpole at the gate. And this could be subject to many different interpretations, but I think one is that if you have any idea of what the Dharma is, if you think, for instance, that you can be given something besides a golden robe, or that there is something to give, or that there is anything to cling to with respect to Dharma transmission, you've got to knock down that idea. So there is nothing to get. Knock down the flagpole that says it needs to be anyway. And this applies to the popularization of Zen. Don't cling strictly to any certain idea. Don't cling too strictly to tradition so that we forget our bodhisattva vow and fail to share the practice with others. Don't cling too strongly to a desire to expand and reach people. Don't expand for expansion's sake. So constantly knock down pre-existing ideas and biases. and the process of working out these issues about the popularization of Zen. This is our practice, and we will keep at it. So the verse for Ananda is, wisteria withered, trees fallen, mountains crumbled, valley streams gush forth, and sparks pour out from the stones. Wisteria withered, trees fallen, mountains crumbled, valley streams gush forth, and sparks pour out from the stones. So knock down the flagpole. If you do that, everything crumbles, and from the ruins, vivid life and freedom emerge. So that's what I have to say about Kazon. And we have a little bit of time here. If anyone would like to speak, please do so. If you're online, you can raise your hand. If you're in the room, same, I guess. Yes.
I really enjoyed your story. You mentioned that a part of our practice is not holding too rigid of ideas, mm-hmm. but also at the same time preserving the essence of Zen Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And my question comes from, I started to meditate a long time ago because I read Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've approached meditation with no practice, no really background knowledge. I simply did the practice, and that eventually led me here to learning what goes on in this Zen meditation center. And so I guess my question is, what do you think the essence might be?
Yeah.
Because I have no background in this practice, and yet I came to this temple and there was a lot of strange practices here, like the chanting and stuff like that. And it was hard to adapt to. Mm-hmm. But as I continue to do it, it's like, oh, I can do this. This can be a part of my practice. But what is that essence from your perspective?
Yeah, what is that essence? That's a very good question. I don't know if I can answer that directly, but I can talk a little bit about how to think about it, maybe.
Yeah.
And so these forms have been developed over hundreds of years to help us to wake up. And some go back 2,500 years, mm-hmm. like the pattern on our robes goes back 2,500 years. And some of the things we've inherited from our ancestors is cultural, and some of it is specifically about Zen. One thing I'm hoping about my trip to Japan is maybe I'll be able to see the difference a little bit. I don't know. But we inherit all of this stuff, and it is designed to wake us up. And to what extent do you have to follow the forms exactly in order to wake up? Well, probably not exactly. They have evolved in every place that Buddhism has gone to. It changed a great deal upon moving from India to China, China to Japan, and Japan to here. So it's all about waking up. And to what extent do the forms help us? There are a lot of opinions about that. I think the forms help us a great deal from my personal experience, like bowing, doing full bows, doing chanting, doing more yogi. All of that stuff has really helped me. And other folks think that that's not very helpful. And some folks are happy with sort of no forms at all. And, you know, I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. And I don't want to be too quick to discard the forms because I want to honor the Buddhas and ancestors. And once you stop doing something, you're probably never going to get it back. So let's keep it. We do alter things. We change things all the time, but I like to be slow to do that. So what's the essence? The essence is it helping you wake up or is it an impediment? And we'll find that over time.
I love it.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the questions. Okay. Anyone else? I hear some activity out there, but I think we may have about 4 more minutes. So anyone would like to kindly help me fill the space. Don't make me come up with something spontaneous. There's no room for that incident. Yes, here we go.
I was wondering if you were here. I was wondering during your talk is when you mentioned the sequence of ancestors, you know, like the 52 ancestors and Dogons and that. Are those ancestors a teaching, like one of the mentor, the one after, or the, like a literal ancestry? Or what is the meaning?
Once it got to China, there was a literal connection that each one was a teacher who kind of officially authorized the student to be their successor. And so it's pretty clear that way. In India, some of that may have been made up after the fact. So there is this kind of whole sort of official and institutional thing that happens, which is kind of, you know, a mixed blessing because it helps people to know like who their teacher is and what their training is and things like that. But of course, being awake does not always exactly correspond to the changes and authorizations that are made within an institution, you know. And of course, there are lay people who are awakened like these priests, and maybe, you know, the true Dharma might follow not quite so straight a path. So we value the tradition and hierarchy, I think, very much, and we honor it, but we're not so deluded as to think that there's something magical and sacred about it. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you. All right. Well, I think, oh, good. Thank you.
I was struck in the story that because knocked it on the flagpole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, I could have said, like, knocked down the gateways or knocked up this or that. And why a flagpole?
Oh.
And so I thought, oh, a flagpole is where you can fly your partner, sort of proclaiming, here I am, here's who I am, and knocked on the banner.
Yeah, that's true. But there's also a story behind that, which is that apparently at this time in India, they would have debates among the monks, and there would be two flagpoles, and or maybe there was one flagpole, and if you won the debate, your banner got run up. So this is also kind of about winning and losing and wanting to best other people. So like, maybe Kashyapa is saying, so Ananda, you're running up your flag. You're thinking about getting the brocade robe and what it means and how it's going to be a big deal for you. And you need to kind of drop those ideas, because Dharma transmission is not about something glorious for the student. It's about the student kind of erasing themselves so they can serve the community. So thanks for that question. And I see a hand up online.
Hi, I just had a question. Building off of the question earlier about essence and about Eckhart Tolle, I was curious, Eckhart Tolle talks a lot about being in the present moment, and you spoke about being awake, and I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship between being in the present moment and being awake.
Yeah, the relationship between being in the present moment and being awake, I think it's the same thing, because awakeness is just completely characterized by being in the moment, by having the freedom to allow things to change, to not hold on to what has gone before or to look forward to what goes next. And of course, sometimes we have to pay attention to those things in order to survive and do what we need to do. But basically, that's it. It's about being here right now. And of course, the many forms I've mentioned and talked about this morning are designed to help us with that. The forms are kind of hard. If you're new when you come to a service, come to our 20-minute service on Saturday, you're going to be a little challenged because there's a lot going on. There's a lot of bowing and everything. And you're kind of forced to be in the moment because you really have to pay attention. And at first you're kind of in the moment because you're worried about doing it right. And eventually you're in the moment because you're not worried about it and you're just doing it. You're just going along and you don't have to think about it, which is a nice thing that happens. And okay, we set. All right. I have my script. I'd like to take a moment and invite some special guests to join us for an important presentation. This Sunday, April 7th, we are celebrating the birth of the Buddha. Our guests will educate us about the Buddha's birthday and the Japanese Hana Matsuri ceremony.
Before we begin, would any adults like a mask? Anyone else? We have two more.
Years ago, in what is now called Nepal, Queen Maya had a beautiful dream. Four spirits came to her and led her to a lake high up in the Himalayan mountains, where they covered her with perfume and flowers.
A white elephant with a white lotus flower in its trunk sat next to Queen Maya. The white elephant let Queen Maya know that she would soon have a child who would become the Buddha. After 10 lunar months, Queen Maya went home to see her relatives. On the way, she walked into a field of flowers in a place called the Lumbini Garden and held on to the branch of a sal tree for support. The child Buddha appeared. He took 7 steps, pointed to the sky and to the ground, and said, "Above heavens, below the earth, I am the Honored One." As he said this, 8 great dragons swooped down from above and caused sweet rain to fall down.
The Buddha's birthday is celebrated during the spring in many parts of Asia. In Japan, Buddha's birthday story is remembered on April 7th in a flower festival called Hana Matsuri. Since the spring is a time for celebrating new life and growth, this is a time also when people in Japan celebrate young children and pray for their health.
At Hana Matsuri, Japanese temples are decorated with flowers, and a white elephant is constructed from paper to symbolize peace, honor, wisdom, and patience. The flower altar that is built for the ceremony is called a Hanamido. The Hanamido represents the wood in the Lumbini Garden where the Buddha was born. A small Buddha statue with one hand pointing up and one hand pointing down is placed inside the Hanamido. The community bathes the Buddha statue by pouring tea made from amacha leaves over its left shoulder.
This sweet tea represents the rain that purified the Buddha at his birth. Please help us honor the Buddha by bathing our statue with sweet tea. You can take a small vial of the tea for your home altar. Happy birthday and happy continuation to the Buddha. Now let's turn things back over to Ted to continue our morning activities.
We'd like to invite a few of those in the Zendo to come up and bathe the baby Buddha. Maybe 4 or 5 people. Maybe some folks with about them. Here's a volunteer. Here's another. Well, thanks especially to our special guests. And okay, why don't we bring this to a close and turn things over to our Doan, who has some very important announcements.